Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to The Critic podcast. The Northern Ireland Protocol is part of the Brexit deal that Boris Johnson signed in 2019, which commits the UK to imposing checks on goods entering Northern Ireland that the EU believe are at risk of entering the Republic of Ireland. The DUP says by creating trading barriers between parts of the UK, it undermines the act of union, but supporters say it's a necessary consequence of Brexit and is needed to protect the Belfast Agreement and prevent a hard border being erected on the island of Ireland.
Speaking about the Northern Ireland Protocol for a recent BBC programme for Northern Ireland's centenary, the Prime Minister said he was removing the unnecessary perturbances and barriers that have grown up. We're getting the barnacles off the thing and sandpapering it into shape. He, of course, famously told the DUP's party conference in 2018 that he would never put a border in the Irish Sea before agreeing to put in place, in his own words, perturbances and barriers between Great Britain and Northern Ireland as part of his revised withdrawal agreement. And this morning, the PM spokesman said there were no current plans to trigger Article 16, the mechanism to dismantle the protocol, but that they weren't ruling it out. And to talk about all of this, I'm delighted to be joined today by two guests. Simon Hoare is a Conservative MP and the chair of the Northern Ireland Select Committee, and David Hoey is a Northern Ireland businessman and producer of the Political OD podcast. Simon, perhaps we could just start with you. I think it's fair to say your position on the protocol has been fairly positive. Maybe you could just start by saying, you know, why it's there. You know, the Prime Minister admits now it's been causing some problems for trade within the UK, and unionists say it's been a disaster and it's only been around since January the 1st. So you know, why do we need the protocol? What was it put there for?
Well, I mean, to answer those questions, I mean, maybe not in the order in which they were asked. I certainly think it's too early to come to a definitive view one way or the other. But certainly, you know, we need to keep it under review. Why is it there? Well, basically, because the European Union need to protect, perfectly understandably, the integrity of their single market in the same way that we need to respect and maintain the integrity of our internal market. And therefore, on a balanced judgment call, and you know, nobody would have started off by designing the protocol, but in a balanced judgment call, trying to meet the competing and conflicting tensions that Brexit and the Good Friday Agreement throw up when they collide with each other, then the East-West solution, when it's working well, can work, I think, very well as far as Northern Ireland is concerned, because it does have that unique benefit, which not enough attention has been paid to hitherto, and I rather hope that it can be and will be, which is the one foot in two camps, one foot in the single market and one foot in the internal market. And that provides trading and economic opportunities for Northern Ireland. And we know that as a part of the UK, they need those opportunities more than quite a lot of parts of the UK. But it puts at a distinct trading advantage businesses in NI to a much better advantage than, say, businesses in my constituency of North Dorset. So I know it always sounds trivial when we talk about ironing out creases and addressing teething problems, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we're only 4 months in to its operation after 40 years of businesses and others getting used to one way of doing business. I mean, I think to an extent we should be surprised by the lack of problems which there has been. I think many of us were braced for far greater problems than we've actually seen. And part of the problem, I think, has been was the lateness. My select committee, all of last year, have been pressing ministers for an early decision and an early route map so business could get their head around what they would need to do. In essence, that only came into practical currency during the last month of last year. And that was on top of the challenges which business had faced with COVID, seasonal holidays of Christmas and the New Year. So I think it's amazing that GB and NI businesses have shown such ingenuity, patience, perseverance, resilience, and preparedness to to give things a go. And, you know, I think we should salute those business women and men who have been doing just that, who have been keeping the wheels on the bus. Yes.
David, Simon says there that the Northern Ireland Protocol offers businesses a unique opportunity with a foot in both camps. And, you know, supporters of the protocol say that it was designed to protect the Belfast Agreement, and without checks on between GB and Northern Ireland, there'd have to be checks on the island of Ireland, which would lead to violence. And David, you campaigned to leave the EU. You know, what would you say to that?
There's a whole list of things wrapped up in that question. So I'll go back to perhaps looking at the why we are where we are, and whether that is really sustainable in terms of what the Northern Ireland Protocol is currently being, I guess, interpreted as meaning. First of all, if we go right back to the government's, I don't know if it was a white paper, but certainly their stated intention of for Brexit, and in particular in relation to trade between Ireland and the United Kingdom, the idea of cross-border trade was that, largely speaking, we're really looking at a small amount of companies amounting to an awful lot of the trade into the Republic. And indeed, 60% of all trade, back in 2017 or so, 60% of all trade from Northern Ireland to the EU were into the Republic. So, you know, the EU represented a very small part of Northern Ireland trade overall. The cross-border movement of goods, again, predominantly, a lot of that 60% was probably in milk, in live animals for slaughter, in beef plants, and I think chickens come north, if I remember rightly. Pigs come north, beef goes south, something like that. You have a large, I suppose, a number of engineering companies, perhaps, that would send large capital goods down south. But you almost had a 80-20 rule. About 20% of business in Northern Ireland, 20% businesses, really, that they were the big ones that amounted to, by value, by volume of trade. 80% of trade was small business and just the incidentals of buying stuff in the north and moving it to the south. Some border trade in that respect. People going to Tesco's or Asda. People buying small trade goods and taking it across. So the British government was fairly relaxed in the early days, of course, so was the Irish government, and they were talking about how can we practically achieve this. When Leo Varadkar became Taoiseach in the Republic, that changed, and all of a sudden it became entirely orientated to the EU, and we've seen the video recordings where the EU, Barnier and his team, were discussing how Ireland would be a good means of holding the UK within negotiations and extracting a benefit from the negotiations back to the EU. So the nature of the Northern Ireland Protocol, as it was developed in the backstop and then created, I guess, as it were, into a front stop, ended up with us being in a hybrid situation in Northern Ireland. And I hear people say that it can be the best of both worlds. And we'd have to see if that comes to it. But the damage in terms of the East-West trade is substantial. Now, large companies, of course, a lot of this is easy to deal with. And the costs are fairly small relative to a high value or a trade that is, let's say, a ton of steel brought over on a ferry might only attract an extra £150 of carriage. But let's say you want to bring over a pallet of paper clips or perhaps copy paper. That would also have £150 slapped on it. And that starts to eat into the margins of small businesses. And small businesses, I think, are the ones that are really going to get hit quite badly because the overall cost is quite high. And that also includes small businesses no longer able to sell by internet without having their core costs increase because they've had to buy in with the extra costs of paperwork and import costs into Northern Ireland, and then trying to sell into a GB market, which was their big market, against people who don't have to carry those costs. And of course, as all of us have discovered in Northern Ireland, there are a lot of items that are no longer readily accessible via Amazon or by the many other sites we use, like Etsy, eBay, Not in the High Street, where small companies just can't be bothered with the scale. And we've seen that on some foodstuffs as well. Kent supplier of Stilton just said he's not supplying Ireland as a whole, not just Northern Ireland.
David, can you see any merit in Simon's argument that it provides the best of both worlds for any types of companies?
I think for large international corporate businesses, you could see how, given that this is broadly going to be, the costs involved are largely accounting, where they're able to take on extra staff at a marginal cost to the overall business, then I could see where they would perhaps gain businesses. You could argue, if it wasn't for the grace period on medicines, that there would be an advantage in pharma companies moving operations into Northern Ireland because they would have full access perhaps to the single market, but also the security of law within the United Kingdom, that we certainly have seen that the EU is perfectly capable of simply tossing aside when it suits them with their effort to, first of all, invoke Article 16 and then simply walk away from that when they suddenly realised how damaging it was for their reputation, which of course it was.
Simon, what do you think of that argument then? Could this potentially be good, but only for big businesses? Is this just kind of crony capitalism that's pricing out the little people?
No. I think it could be good for lots of businesses. I mean, David has mentioned pharma. I certainly think in the whole sphere of adding value to raw product through food processing, there is a lot, there's real scope, I think, for growth there in the Northern Ireland economy. I think there is scope for any business that wants to be in business, drawing upon an enthusiastic and skilled workforce which exists within Northern Ireland, with a real, appetite for entrepreneurship, inventiveness and the like, the home of Titanic and Game of Thrones. Who could ask for anything more, as it were? So I think this is something which could benefit all businesses, and even, but in, with realistic prospects, accountancy, banking, finance, law, those sorts of things. Great opportunities, yeah. Right across the piece.
But Simon, the protocol seems to have mostly angered the unionist community. The DUP are particularly annoyed. There's another unionist party that seems to be snapping at their heels, and they say it undermines the Act of Union 1801, which prevented trade barriers being erected between Britain and Ireland, which then carried over for Northern Ireland. Whilst the Conservative government is trying to make the case for the union in Scotland, is this kind of best of both worlds argument not just fatally undermining
that?
Well,
I'm a unionist. I don't think we base why the unity of GB, i.e. sort of Scotland, England and Wales, is based on the Act of Union with Scotland. I think the arguments have matured and moved on. I'm going to be careful in answering that question because, of course, it's subject to an action before the courts. But certainly the evidence I've seen, I asked the House of Commons Library to do me a briefing paper on it, and because the Good Friday Agreement supersedes the Act of Union in many respects, then in actual fact, I don't find it a compelling argument. And whilst I'm not a lawyer, I must add that caveat, I think that's one of the easiest arguments to strike for the judge to strike down when they hear it advocated.
So you think that potentially the Belfast Good Friday Agreement has disapplied the Act of Union?
Yes, because it takes precedent And you know, we just have to go with that. I think it strikes though to a broader question, which I'm exploring with in all traditions and all voices and shades of opinion, which is really as follows: when we didn't have borders and regulatory checks and all the rest of it, i.e., when we were all part of the EU single market, it didn't make the UK feel any more European. If it had done, we probably wouldn't have needed the referendum. And if we had had the referendum, the result might have been very, very different. So I think what we have to do, it's addressing the important point that David made earlier, which is access to goods and services and products. That's what we have to make sure that the protocol is delivering in a seamless way, and which is easy for business to get its head around and deliver. I've yet to be convinced. Now, it may be that there is an argument out there, which I just haven't heard it to date, but I've yet to be convinced that anybody really, in all honesty, identifies their sense of belonging, emotional attachment to a state, to a flag, to a tradition, to a culture, whatever it may happen to be, by the regulatory trading regimes which get their breakfast cereal from one place to another. I don't see it in this sort of constitutional point that this in some, it's a trade agreement, it's not a constitutional agreement. Nobody who feels British today in Northern Ireland should feel no more or no less British as a result of the protocol than they did this time last year, or indeed the year before that. I think it's unfortunate that there are people who are trying to wrap this sort of constitutional outrage into something which is just a trading arrangement.
David, you surely have something to say about that.
If we take it in two parts, first of all, on the legal front, I think it's right not to prejudge the judicial review that is going to be heard, I believe, in May time. But I think we can look back to what court has said about Brexit. And of course, one of the many court cases that was brought forward that no one really talks about was that there was no collision of the Good Friday Agreement and Brexit. And the court said that there was no reason, according to the Good Friday Agreement, to stop Brexit in whatever iteration it came through. So I think we can at least stand over that. And I think the issue in terms of at risk, the integrity of the single market, what we can ask, the question there is one around what risk does goods flowing freely into Northern Ireland pose to the EU single market? And that is a legal issue as well.
I absolutely agree with you on that. I mean, I'm not sure what figures you've seen. I've certainly seen figures that about, is it 89% of foodstuffs which come from GB into NI come via supermarket supply chains into their own supermarkets? They have no strategic risk of getting into the EU single market. And I would agree that I think there needs to be some flexibility and a greater degree of smartness, if you will, with being able to identify things which are at risk.
But similarly, somebody buying a washing machine in Uri and taking it over Dundalk will not bring down the single market of the European Union. So I think if we take back to the legal side, and supermarkets is a bit of a distraction because those are, again, big corporates rather than the small trader. So I think we have to look at it in the round, not simply to the big guys who can shout loudly and get their derogations. In the process at the moment of ordering masks from a company in the world. And that the issue has it raised about having those delivered. And that becomes a matter of customs check. Now, you know, 6 months ago, they'd have stuck them in a box and posted them to me. Now, there is going to be an additional cost in that delivery. And if you think that that's just a mere economic transaction, that makes me feel really annoyed. And it does make me feel that I am not a an equal citizen in the sense that I can simply pick up the phone and order something from another part of my country and get it the same as anybody could in Simon's constituency. So yeah, I think there are issues. It's not going to bring my Britishness, but my sense of fairness and propriety is certainly affected by the fact that, you know, again, people wanting to just send things over, you have to find the workarounds that aren't necessarily legal and could in fact prevent. I've had a friend who tried to send a gift to his mother for Mother's Day, and it was an absolute nightmare to make an arrangement for that gift to be delivered. It wasn't just simply a matter, again, of picking something out and having it sent to her from John Lewis, as he has done in the past.
David, you make an important point, if it's not untoward for me to say so, but I think the one thing which the protocol has slightly masked is that from the 1st of January, I think all parts of the UK have had some disruptions to their supply chains. It hasn't just been things being delivered to Northern Ireland. It's been stuff coming from the continent into GB, where there has also been delays. There's been loss of trade. I'm dealing with at least half a dozen cases at the moment of businesses in my constituency are just having the most terrible time getting their stuff into their traditional markets in the EU. And I think, you know, there is this, I don't know if it's naivety or, I mean, I'm sort of slightly surprised by the bewilderment that everybody thought that it would be possible for any country to effectively turn the clock from, you know, one day to the next with a whole new set of trading arrangements, and there would be no teething problems. There have been teething problems between GB and NI, but there have been huge teething problems between the rest of the EU and from and to GB.
With all due respect, Simon, I'm not talking about importing from another country. I'm talking about buying something within my own country. And that's the difference. I totally accept it that there would be disruption. And indeed, one of the things that isn't being pointed out, and I think, again, COVID is probably suppressing the difficulties that will arise, is the substantial dislocation of trade with the Republic of Ireland from GB, which people have just simply not noticed as yet. And the Republic of Ireland has brought in derogations in its tax offices to ease trade, because they are having tremendous difficulties in coping with Brexit, coping with the final agreement. But there is a difference between being in another country and being in your own country and having that disruption, particularly when it's a matter of just of ordering something that would have been routine 6 months ago. This is my own country. This is not another. And if you're talking about Britishness, you should not have to organize customs paperwork to import to get something sent to you from across a strip of water.
Well, we're all having to get used to new arrangements, and you know the regulatory border had to go somewhere. And I mean, there is this sort of temptation, and let me be clear, I'm not suggesting that David is suggesting this, but there are a lot of people who say, well, let's get rid of the protocol, and then everything will be fine and dandy. But if you got rid of the East-West, you're going to have to put it North-South. And that has another lot of knock-on effects for business, for stability, for confidence in the investor community, in the integrity of the GFA, etc. As I say, you know, none of this has been easy stuff. I mean, I wasn't instinctively a sort of, you know, fanatical pro-European, but a lot of my Remain position in the referendum was predicated on the huge challenges that delivering Brexit would bring to the island of Ireland, because you did have this conflict, whether one liked it or not, with the principles of the Good Friday Agreement, which were written at a time when it was never expected or anticipated that the Republic or the UK would ever leave the EU. That was always written as a sort of one of the sort of foundation stones on which you could base the Good Friday Agreement, that we were all parts of the same single market, that we were all parts.
It was never discussed.
No, you're right, David. In the same way that, you know, lots of people won't discuss things like if the car won't start tomorrow, or if their leg falls off. It was never discussed because it was just not envisaged. It wasn't even when the Good Friday Agreement was entered into. Nobody thought, you know, we just had sort of Jimmy Goldsmith in his referendum campaign in the 97 election, hadn't won a single seat. You had a very pro-European Union Labour government coming in with a massive majority. You had the Republic, very pro-European Union. I wasn't aware of a great sort of hotbed of Euroscepticism within Northern Ireland, who, after all, even as late as the referendum, voted my majority to stay in. It wasn't considered because it was probably seen as just being such an unrealistic prospect that consideration needn't be given to it.
But Simon, you say that the border couldn't go north-south. I mean, but wouldn't unionists argue, you know, that there already are different tax rates north and south, there's already ANPR cameras, there already is smuggling north-south, then why would you create a border where there isn't one instead of strengthening a border where there already is one?
Well, sorry, David, just to add on to that one as a question, and that is, if Boris Johnson is saying that the Northern Ireland Protocol in its implementation should be so light touch that people shouldn't notice, then why shouldn't that be between Northern Ireland and the Republic rather than at the docks in Northern Ireland at Larne and Belfast and wherever? So, you know, if it's that light touch and it's not going to be seen, it's not even going to be noticed, why shouldn't it be on the land border? There's no practical reason why a border in terms of goods cannot be managed through the systems and not be managed physically.
Well, I mean, we heard for 4 years about these alternative arrangements that could deliver a border north-south, which wouldn't offend against the Good Friday Agreement and would not be visible to the naked eye. And at no point before or after have we had any flesh put on those particular bones. So we keep being told what isn't wanted and isn't palatable and is not liked. But there's no realistic alternative that has ever been proposed which would be acceptable to the British government, to the Irish government, and to the European Commission. This is a triangulated need for agreement. And so I think the challenge is to get that invisible, light-touch regulatory regime predicated on the principles of the protocol, rather than continually dangling the as yet to be defined alternatives in front of people to say, well, latch onto this, and then just find that they've latched onto a whole pile of thin air. What I do have enormous sympathy with is that hindsight is that great skill which politicians always wish they'd had. I think the government could have been and should have been far clearer in not just what was being delivered, but why, taking people into their confidence as to their thinking, into their rationale, into their strategy. And then I think people would, they may still not like what they arrive at, but I think what is fueling this, and I have great sympathy for it, is that a lot of people feel that they've been taken for, not taken for a ride, but taken for fools, that they've only been shown partial bits of the truth or given the bits which they think that the giver feels may be palatable. And there's no point trying to pretend that there isn't a border east-west, because there is. But it makes it a bit more palatable if you explain that the border has to go somewhere. And this is why we've chosen, why the government chose this way rather than the other way. I hope it's not too late to do some of that explanation, but I feel that an awful lot of people have been annoyed by its absence. And it's a big ask to ask them to reflect upon the reasons, but they have to be given them, and they have to be given them in a common sense, clear way.
We're fast running out of time, but perhaps you could just answer this, Simon. Are you concerned at all by the government deciding to unilaterally act on some of these grace periods, unilaterally extending the grace periods given to supermarkets?
Well, I mean, as I said in the Commons, the need for the extensions was very clear. And my understanding is that clarity was understood by the European Union. And there wasn't any particular need for unilateral action because it could have been agreed mutually. We are where we are. But a lot of this, this finessing of the protocol, needs to be based on trust. And unilateral action, where you have an international agreement which has dispute remedies written within it, to build that relationship of trust is not best served by unilateral action from either side. And so, you know, they had one over the vaccines. We've had one over this. The David Frost roadmap, which I hugely welcome as a way of fleshing out to the EU what the government is going to be doing within this extended period in order to make to deliver in full the protocol, that of itself has to be welcomed. But let us now hope that there is that relationship of mutual trust such that unilateral activity will no longer be required.
David, perhaps you could give one final kind of thought. You know, the idea that Simon mentions that it would really break down trust if we just start triggering Article 16 and extending grace periods, and it would potentially undermine our trade agreements if people around the world think that they can't take Britain at its word, if it was just going to break agreements that it makes.
I think if there had been trust, you wouldn't have the Northern Ireland Protocol. I think the EU has a very singular view of what it wants to achieve. It wants to make Brexit hurt. Northern Ireland is a Trojan horse that will continue to basically gnaw away at Boris and the rest. And if the price is the breakup of the Union, I don't think the EU will give two figs. I don't think the Good Friday Agreement featured in any particular great aspect of the EU's thinking, other than how its spirit, some elusive and peculiar idea of what it actually was, could be used to basically extract greater concession and to make it difficult for Brexit to succeed. At the end of the day, we are where we are, as Simon says, but there's going to have to be a whole lot of work done to basically pull it round. And I'm still waiting for the answer that if this protocol can be made so light touch, why can't that light touch border not be between Northern Ireland and the Republic?
Well, I'm afraid that really is all we've got time for this week. But thank you both very much for coming on and speaking about the Northern Ireland Protocol. Hopefully we understand it slightly more and the arguments slightly more. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.